WTOP News, this is The Book Report. I'm Tariq King. The term cancel culture has evolved into a cultural lightning rod. Some call it a form of censorship and mob rule, while others say it's a means of delivering accountability and justice. On this WTOP Book Report, Ernest Owens, author of The Case for Cancel Culture. Ernest is an award-winning journalist and the editor-at-large for Philadelphia Magazine. His book, The Case for Cancel Culture, posits that cancel culture is essentially a new term for an age-old phenomenon. On the eve of the book's release, I talked to Ernest about his reasons for embracing the notion of cancel culture, which he says is an effective tool of modern democracy, and why he pushes back against critics who disparage the term. Thank you for joining me today, Ernest.
Thank you for having me on. This is super exciting.
Congratulations on the release of the book. So let's talk about cancel culture. It's one of these terms that we hear a lot. We hear it used a lot in the general lexicon nowadays, and it's wielded sometimes as sort of a weapon, a criticism of another point of view. Why did you feel that a book was necessary on the topic?
Because I think, you know, as a journalist, I have written short form, I've written op-eds, I've done investigative pieces, long form pieces, and I've read some people's take and it just wasn't there. It just wasn't long enough. There was just so much that had to be said about cancel culture that I think it deserved a book. I've read previous books that were out by others who were giving a very straight up con against it. They were against it. It was a complete attack on the term and what it meant. And I just felt like that was a very myopic way of looking at the topic. But I couldn't find really any books that explored it in this lens and even made a case for it. And that was where my passions were. You know, I had wrote an op-ed, a guest op-ed for the New York Times, critiquing, you know, Obama's what I called boomer view of cancel culture.
A lot of the dangers of cancel culture and, you know, we're just going to be condemning people all the time. At least among my daughters, that they'll acknowledge that sometimes among their peer group or in college campuses, you know, you'll see folks going overboard. But they have a pretty good sense of, we don't expect everybody to be perfect. We don't expect everybody to be politically correct all the time. But we are going to call out institutions or individuals if they are being cruel, if they are discriminating against people. We do want to raise awareness.
And even within there, there was so many points that I made that I wish I was able to expand upon. And the more and more I read and more I just saw people getting it wrong, I thought this book was going to get it right. And I believe it did.
Now, this isn't some academic white paper on the subject,
no.
Right? Like it's right there in the title, The Case for It. So you are for it. Make the case. Why are you for it?
I'm leaning into it because I think that what people have tried to get out of cancel culture is a sense of purity that we don't see in any other institution that tries to arbitrate or, you know, somehow call for accountability. When we look at our criminal justice system, it's flawed. It has imperfections. But people are not collectively saying we should just throw away the courts, throw away every level of public accountability elsewhere. You know, people debate every day about, you know, should they dismantle it and abolish the police? Some people think they should, but a lot of people in this country don't believe that is necessary. So my argument is for cancel culture is that I think cancel culture has done more good than harm. I think that there are people who will always weaponize it as a tool, but it's a tool. Okay, if you give it in the hands of bad people will do bad things. But if you give it in the hands of marginalized voices that are trying to speak truth to power, I think that this is the only democratic vessel we have when the courts fail, when the police system fails, when every other institution fails, the power goes to the people. And what we do with that power in canceling and asking for accountability and asking for things to change, this is what this is.
Is there a difference between cancel culture and political correctness?
I don't think so. I think that these terms and these labels is what people have used as a way to misinterpret what's happening. When we hear people say Black Lives Matter is divisive, that's a term used to distract what they're actually doing. And the people who are creating these terms or pushing them or reframing them are oftentimes people in power that do not want people to come after them, right? So, you know, when you see a lot of celebrities who get in controversy or do something wrong, they'll say things like, the devil's trying to get me. Well, who's the devil? Is the devil the courts? Is the devil law enforcement? Is the devil victims who are accusing you of doing something that you did? You know, we use different words to try to dismiss what is really happening. And it seems like when it comes to people holding people accountable, the accountability gets reframed as something malicious. Like, you know, former President Donald Trump, whenever journalists were trying to go after him, he called it fake news. He called it a witch hunt. You know, he used all these other pejoratives to try to deflect from accountability. And I think cancel culture has been the oogie boogie man that both the left and the right who are in power have used to try to scare people and shame people into holding them accountable.
And you say that cancel culture, although the term might be new, the practice is actually nothing new. You say it's been here all along. And in the book, you cite some prominent examples in history. A lot of these examples are things that the culture celebrates, Boston Tea Party, et cetera. Some prominent events in history that are examples of what cancel culture is, in your view. Give me one or two of those.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for starters, I go back to the beginning of time, you know, to say how people use religion as a way to create a moral code. It was driven by canceling something, canceling behavior, canceling sins, indulgences. Adam and Eve, you know, I think the first group of people in history that was canceled was Adam and Eve for violating, for eating the apple. Shouldn't have ate the apple. They were canceled. That was the first example of cancel culture. And when you think about it, all of those events created and shaped morality. Canceling things have always not been about just harming people, but it was making a statement about our views and our ethics and our ideals, whether we agreed or not, right? So in my book, I talk about it in ways that are favorable, but I also talk about it in ways that were controversial. So we think about Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, who was a televangelist, who basically wanted to ban the Teletubbies because he thought that the Teletubbies, especially Tinky Winky, was promoting homosexuality on television.
That was the purple one, right?
The purple one, yes, with the triangle, upside down triangle. He thought that this was a problematic figure and wanted the show canceled. And I want to be clear that even though I personally do not believe with Jerry Falwell's belief about the Teletubbies, it's something to be said that there were people who were actively getting behind this concept. And they did it not because they didn't think the TV show was good, but because they really had a moral inclination to say, this has to go. And that's fascinating to me because we've seen this happen today. We're witnessing cancel culture before our very eyes. We're seeing Don't Say Gay from Ron DeSantis, who I think is the official political poster child for cancel culture in modern day. He is canceling, you know, things like Don't Say Gay. He is putting out opportunities and promoting the banning and the canceling of AP courses on African-American studies. There's book bans happening throughout the country from the conservatives. They want to ban certain books. All of this is cancel culture.
You say cancel culture gives individuals who do not have institutional, social, or cultural power a platform to hold those in power accountable. So in your view, it's a bottom-up phenomenon, right? If someone who has institutional political power wants to say, you know, we're not allowing a certain people of a certain race to live in a certain area, well, that's not cancel culture because it's not a bottom-up phenomenon. Am I on the right track?
In my viewpoint, I don't see everyday people being canceled. I don't think everyday people are being canceled in the same ways that we see a massive viewpoint. So you're not canceled in this day and age, you're not being canceled by everyday people. Powerful people are canceling everyday people. But us everyday people are not canceling ourselves.
Not canceling other everyday people. You're reaching to cancel the powerful. So that was one of the questions I had. Is power a precursor to being canceled?
It's all about it. It is a precursor. Because to be real, like if you go, like for example, you know, on your show, Tariq, if you say something that is misogynistic or racist or homophobic or problematic, you're going to, if your job decides to fire you, you was not canceled because you know why? You signed a contract and they're mostly going to tell you that you violated something in your code of conduct. Powerful people, what happens to the Harvey Weinsteins? Do Harvey Weinstein have a code of conduct at Miramax? When you're the CEO of the company, do Jeff Bezos have the same level of accountability that all of us mere folk have?
No, but I actually think that I, in my position, I probably could be subject to a call for cancellation by the audience. if not by my employers, no?
You could, but the reality is that if whether or not you did or didn't, could we not change that into feedback that, hey, there is a judicial system here that maybe, let's say you go out on the street and you do a crime and someone else sees it and they call the police. That's not them calling the council. These are already systems in place that are meant to protect. Cancel culture typically comes in when there are situations where people feel like there's an injustice or something wrong, and there's no immediate way to do it. This is when it's at a point where it cannot be handled internally, where you can't come to the table and it's not a simple apologize or whatnot. When you look at your situation, whether or not people rallied against you or would rally against you for whatever you said, you have a manager you have to answer to. And if that manager makes the call and decision, it overrides whatever manipulation could be or not be in the outside dynamic. Powerful people don't have that same situation. You look at R. Kelly. R. Kelly went over 25 years of doing very problematic, illegal things. And the fans and the different people out there was calling it out. But the powers that be, no one could check him because he had so much money and influence that the industry didn't want to shut him down. He owned all his managers. He owned all of this influence that he couldn't easily be canceled. It took literally a documentary and hundreds of Black women across the country to create a global hashtag movement, hashtag New R. Kelly, before there was a larger wave to get him to finally face some accountability. The same could be said about Harvey Weinstein. This man had literally been doing this stuff for years and people knew about it. And what did they do? Nothing, because there was no system to check him. So it took a bunch of women to get together to once again create public pressure to then lead to his cancellation. If an everyday person that was not famous or had his powers, R. Kelly, that did the things R. Kelly did, he would have been in jail in a heartbeat. We wouldn't be having this conversation. So what makes the difference between a Harvey Weinstein and R. Kelly versus someone in your neighborhood doing the same things? Power, money, all of those things. So when people tell me things like everyday people like, well, I don't want to say this, I don't want to get canceled. Child, no one's canceling you. They're not. They're not canceling. No one's checking for you like that. You're not elected official. You're not a powerful public figure. Like, no one is going to be lobbying behind canceling little old you. If someone at your job doesn't agree or some coworkers disagree, that's not cancel culture. That's you at a code. You signed a contract. You made a deal. These people are not signing code of conducts. These people are not held to the same standards. They don't have check-ins with managers. They don't have performance reports. They don't have the same standards that we do. So when I see everyday people trying to defend these celebrities as if they're one of them, they're absolutely not. It's a whole different game for them based on their power.
You know, one of the smaller bits of knowledge that I gleaned from the book, and I loved it, that you traced the original use of the word cancel in this context back to a 90s film. And that was the first time that it was used this way. Let's not skip that, right? So, because who said it first? People think Black Twitter. Well, yeah, but tell us the first time that it was used in this context.
It was used in New Jack City, where Wesley Snipes' character, whose character was named Nino, says,
"Nino, cancel it. I'll buy it."
He was over it and said, cancel her. And this was in the early 90s. I was born in 1991, but I have heard of New Jack City for so many years. And it comes in full circle because in the mid-2010s, when I was much older, I enjoyed a great reality show called Love and Hip Hop. And this guy named Cisco Rosado, who is on the cast of the show, has a relationship where he basically is with a woman named Diamond Strawberry, who they're breaking up at this restaurant. He wants to cancel the relationship and he literally says he's going to cancel it. And this takes off in Black Twitter. People are like, wow, he decided canceling it. Now, Rosado later said in an interview that he was inspired by saying cancel it because he was inspired by Nino referencing it in New Jack City. So this all started in the confines of Black pop culture. This is a very Black term. This is a very Black thing. And it was something that was ours for decades, and even something that was ours for a moment on Black Twitter. And then people just took it and remixed it and just blew it up, and it blew up. And then now it's lost its entire control. It's lost its entire meaning, its purpose. It was supposed to be a frivolous, funny, tongue-in-cheek, slang that was used amongst other folks to describe ending things that were frivolous and non-important, or in some cases, relationships that don't matter. But this was what it was. And then, of course, the BuzzFeeds of the world and the blogs of the world began to take it and make it something more. And then it lost its meaning in the vernacular of Black people, and it became something that was everyone wanted to use it. And then once everybody started using it, then everybody started using it wrong. And the next thing you know, it's in the mouth of Ted Cruz, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and the rest is history.
Your position seems to be that the dividing lines between those who support it and those who do not are the lines between generations, between political ideologies, race. You wrote race, gender, class, and social status. So essentially, that's older right. people think one thing, younger another, i.e. Barack Obama's boomer view. Left-wing folks think one thing, right-wing another. Do you think that this book will move any minds in either direction?
You know, it could. You know, early people who've read the book, folks that are, you know, people say, what's your target demographic for this book? Everybody. Everybody.
Agreed.
Everybody should be reading it. It's one of those books that I do think everyone should read. There's something that everyone can learn from this. There's history that people clearly don't know. Because really what I'm doing is I am reclaiming this term. I'm reclaiming it.
Right.
I'm reclaiming it for something else, for something better. The initial meaning was something frivolous and silly and fun. I'm reclaiming this to be something of empowerment and something that's democratic. And to be quite honest, making it clear to everybody that before you start going around here shaming people for cancel culture, we're all doing it. We're all canceling. So what my book is doing is saying that we're spending so much time shaming people for making decisions that they believe are just for them. People can choose what they want to cancel. It's us as the public to practice our full-fledged rights, our full-fledged First Amendment rights to challenge those ideals. We've been doing that for decades, for hundreds of years. You think about the civil rights movement. White people want to cancel Black people. They want to cancel Black people having the same rights as them. Jim Crow laws were put in place. This was cancel culture at its finest. But then Black people said, you know what? We don't agree with this cancellation. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to cancel your buses. We're going to have the Montgomery Boys bus boycott. We're going to cancel our support for some of these institutions. And we rose up and we did cancel and we pushed back. And our cancelization led to political change, policy change. And then we got even more rights. I believe that the marginalized folks, Black people, cancel culture gives us that ability to. Because if there was no cancel culture, we wouldn't have our civil rights. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have LGBTQ plus rights. We wouldn't have women's rights. Because here's the funny part about it. Here's what people, this is the most important aspect of the book that I think answers a lot of things that people are not talking about. And I think, you know, the last chapter I get into this is that there's this question of why is it that it seems like people now are really up in arms about cancel culture. Like, why haven't we heard so much about this over the years, people would argue. I argue we have, but what I will say is that in this society, in 2023, in our country, more people have First Amendment right privileges than they did 50 years ago.
I want to go back about 30 years, because there was mm-hmm. something as I was reading the book, I was wondering about an incident or a situation that occurred in the mid-90s where there was a rumor that went out about a powerful white fashion designer, Tommy Hilfiger. Do you remember this
yes.
rumor? This
yes,
rumor that Tommy Hilfiger was racist and anti-Semitic. And he said, apparently they say that he went on Oprah Winfrey's show. Oprah said he's never been on the show, you know, never went on the show and said that. But apparently they say he went on the Oprah Winfrey show and claimed that his clothes were not for Black people, that it was, quote, intended for upper class whites. And if he had known that Blacks would be wearing his clothing, he wouldn't have made them so nice. This is the thing that went around. Now, this is pre-social media. So it went around right. without the aid of social media. And the correction mm-hmm. has been slow to catch up. I believe I'm pretty sure there are people who still believe to this day that that was a true mm-hmm. statement. And I found myself wondering, well, if this had gone about unchecked and cancel culture as we know it and define it today existed, would Tommy Hilfiger likely have been unjustly canceled? So my question then becomes, in a situation like that, how do you make sure you're not canceling the wrong person, the wrong injustice, or the wrong perceived injustice, or the wrong perceived perpetrator of injustice is like sort of rigorous proof beyond a reasonable doubt a factor in this?
Well, you know, what's funny is that everyone asks this much for cancel culture, but they never ask the same question about the criminal justice system in general.
Oh, I do. I do.
But I know you do. I know you do. I'm just saying that. Right. This is a thing that happens, though, right? There's always going to be flaws. It's an imperfect system. I don't have a remedy per se for how we avoid all of those things, right? But they happen. But I just think what it requires is that we have to have a more well-read, more educated populace. Read, be smart, do your research, ask questions. And I think, to be honest, if this Tommy Hilfiger rumor would have been out in the era of social media, like a lot of things, like Monica Lewinsky, I think Monica Lewinsky was definitely canceled in ways at the time that was unjust. But we see things evolve through time. Now look how we talk about Monica Lewinsky. Now look how we talk about Tommy Hilfiger. Let's talk about how we talk about LGBTQ issues. Do you think that any of those times where people thought it was okay to discriminate and be homophobic or to create those norms, the society evolves with the times and technology that we have, right? There are people believing that Black people weren't as, you know, biologically smart as white people. There were people sending out grams. You got Nazi propaganda out there where there was a lot of that anti-Semitic rhetoric about Jewish people. The sign of the times is sometimes there are moments in history that's just unjust based on lack of resources we had, understanding we had, and cultural sensitivity that we have. So, you know, I'm not in the business of retroactively addressing those issues, but I would argue that today, if where we are today, there is more room to counter some of those things better. But if you look back throughout history, yeah. But I would also add, when we say Tommy Hilfiger was canceled, Tommy Hilfiger is still rich. Tommy Hilfiger still got a brand.
Absolutely.
He still got money.
Yeah.
He took a moment. He took a little hit, maybe. But at the end of the day, Tommy Hilfiger, still rich. Okay. Still got a business. You know, I'm thinking about the Chrisette Michelles of the world. Okay.
Who you did mention in the book.
Yeah. Career is completely in a different situation. Even Kanye West's career is weird. He got a lot of room to keep making dumb decisions until recently. But that was because he was also more powerful than Chrisette was. He was also a man. He also, you know, I think about people like Mel Gibson.
Why do you think that some cancel, because when Mel Gibson caused the stir that he caused, he offended a lot of people, and he offended a lot of powerful people, and he offended a lot of people who weren't powerful. So why do you think that some cancellations take while others don't?
So in my book, there's a chapter called Not All Cancellations Are the Same. To put that there to say, listen, before you all start, no, some people are not getting canceled as much, or they're not getting canceled as fast. You know, we see that white men who make certain types of racial behavior aren't getting the same level of scrutiny as others. You know, when I think about what happened to Whoopi Goldberg with The View and the conversations around anti-Semitism around her getting suspended, her having this line of accountability, to which, you know, what's interesting, she was very much, you know, thorough in seeking instant accountability and conversations and dialogue, and even still then was suspended. But when you think about Mel Gibson, this man has these problems and then instantly gets embraced by Hollywood again, gets an Oscar nomination, following that from the Academy, is offered all of these concessions. And so you see that there is a lot of differences within racial lines. There's differences between gender. I think about Paula Deen, where when Paula Deen, as a white older woman, said some racial things, you know, Food Network took her off. But you got Joe Rogan, who got a $200 million deal with Spotify, who said the N-word countless times and other offenses, and they stood by him.
Are people more inclined to cancel or call for cancellation of someone or something that offends them if they don't have to invest too much in it, if it doesn't cause them too much discomfort, if it's just a matter of firing off some tweets and maybe not saying, okay, well, I'm going to cancel this? What do you think about that issue of why folks can be at some times really committed to this idea of cancellation, but when the rubber hits the road, maybe not so much?
Well, we see it all the time. I think there is a double standard, right? I think, you know, in my book, we're in a free market capitalistic society. And so I do believe that people are making decisions that's shaped by power, economic power. Like I'm not the, ooh, I love capitalism on the banner of my house or anything, but in this free market society, we have put a material value to things and we've commodified them. So a lot of the most successful cancel cultures have been rooted in financial and economic divestment. We look at what happened with apartheid, the conversations in America about divestment from South Africa and universities. We talk about them in the book. We talk about a lot of people that did those financial boycotts. You know, MLK knew this very well. You know, we look at Gandhi with the Salt March. All of these moments were rooted in some type of economic divestment. And the truth of the matter is that celebrities, because they are benefiting off of this type of free market above everyday people, they stand to have a lot to lose, which is why I never use them as the litmus test to define the progress of something, because they're fickle. They do it if it's going to lead to an economic advancement for them. Even their protests are not protests. They're protesting for capital. A lot of celebrities do. And so you see a lot of celebrities that will find ways to be in solidarity, but there's always a back check. They'll make a song for a cause, but it's like, oh yeah, but you're also getting a check for the cause. So, you know, there's always a give and take and a financial benefit. And in these situations, these celebrities make these bold moves, and then management calls them and says, actually, you got Miami, you got all these big little hot spots. These are some of your biggest tour locations. You actually need to reconsider. So that's why we see a lot of hypocrisy there. We shouldn't actually not use celebrities, in my opinion, as the litmus test or the barometer to measure progress. It's always going to be with the most marginalized, the most on the ground community people in our neighborhoods.
Along the same lines, cancellations that didn't take, when Colin Kaepernick took a knee and we saw everyone on social media saying, boycott the NFL. Now, these weren't perhaps some celebrities, but these were pretty much everyday people saying they're going to do it. I have seen the ratings for the NFL. They haven't done it. So no. Why do you think this is that whole question of calling for cancellation versus canceling something, perhaps to your own discomfort? You just don't watch the football game. What do you have to say about, you know, that whole question of level of investment?
There is some things, to be fair, we got to look at the power. You know, when I say all cancellations are equal, we got to look at the power of these people, right? The NFL is like the police department to me. They hold so many resources, so much money, billions of dollars, and lots of external power that we don't even see. When I think about the power of the NFL, right, and what it means in cities, like police departments, they bring money into cities, job creation, lots of other resources, scholarships, community investment. It's not as simple as turning the TV off. What the NFL represents and what it's a symbol of is that it's a symbol of American identity, that this is as American as apple pie, that this is a token or a chip of what has defined American masculinity for over a half a century, and that people base their identity off of this type of football, that it's almost a part of their intrinsic value, that when kids get up at 4 years old, Black boys are either getting a football in their hand, a basketball in their hand, or being considered for it before they even get double digits. This is ingrained in our culture and our idea, that the fact that a company owns a day of the week, that they literally own a day of the week, that millions of people, even if you don't care, the entire economy and economic impact of it impacts states across the country, even states that are not even playing the football game. So when you say abolish the NFL, you recognize that you're cutting off an entire economic system that is not being that's not only being defended by the NFL, but by companies, soda companies, advertisers, marketing brands, politicians. It's not just us against the NFL as the league, it's us against capitalism. It's us against fashion. It's us against Roc Nation now, right? Roc Nation has an investment in it. Shame on Jay-Z. But we have all these people that are a part of that larger pie. There is such an investment in this institution beyond just the league itself that if you said abolish the Super Bowl, they're looking like, so how am I going to have money this February? What about those scholarships for those kids? What about my business? My business get a boom around this month. It's tax season. I need this. Baby girl need this for Valentine's Day. I'm selling these bootleg t-shirts. If there's no Super Bowl, I can't make money. So everybody's impact. They've created such a big institution that will create a protection for them. Because to say abolish NFL means all of those things. Personally, I don't care. I'm like, yes, take it all. Let's redo this. But for many people, especially our people, we're in such a messed up economy and capitalist society that they have to co-opt into institutions and things that do not serve them.
So we can cancel things as long as we don't have to deal with any blowback or loss from it, is what I'm hearing.
I am a radical in the sense that I'm also recognizing that people's choice to cancel is rooted in a lot of things that they may personally disagree with, but they're also still humans. That's what makes this a very complicated situation, because it's really the conversation about the act of protest. Like, let's take the word cancel culture out and just say, let's say you're working at a company, your company wants to unionize. You have to make that decision. If you stand out there publicly and decide to unionize, what does the implication mean for your livelihood and your job,
especially
right?
If you're not successful, there's a lot of potential blowback. Yeah.
There's potential blowback. So we have to, doing the right thing requires courage. I mean, that's the theme of this book, is that nobody do these things impulsively. So when I hear people say things like, oh, it's so quick for these people to cancel. No, it's not. Canceling oftentimes is often the last resort. And in my book, I talk about when cancel culture was the only option, because we act like throughout history that people just automatically hit the streets. No, there were several backdoor conversations, several private meetings, several letters, several phone calls, bird chirps, Pony Express, and text messages. And until before it got to that point, when that did not work, then we went out. You know, the history of Black people, we are pragmatic people. We have never been the impulsive type to just go out and just shake the table. We oftentimes are very strategic and measured in our approach. And then when those things did not work, then we said, okay, it's time to turn up.
I'm so glad I got to talk to you today, Ernest. And I really, really, really wish you the best with the book. The book is called The Case for Cancel Culture, not the case of it, not the case around it or something thereabouts it. The case for it. The man's telling you where he's at. Ernest Owens, good luck, man.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. And thank you all for listening. This is The Book Report for WTOP News and WTOP.com. I'm Tariq King.